What's happening? Welcome to Wong Notes Podcast. I'm your host, Corey Wong. I hope you're doing well today. I'm feeling good today. I had a good day mixing. You know, sometimes just good practice day, good performance day, whatever. Dude, I've been mixing my new record and it is sounding dope. I'm very excited. Very fun project I've been working on, and it's about done now. It's about done, and it's about time because it's been taking me a lot of work and hours. So I'm feeling good. Guess what? Because of that, I'm feeling nice. I'm feeling generous. I got a guitar course out there, 25% off right now. Use the coupon code PODCAST. Go search the Corey Wong guitar course. PODCAST is the discount code. Get yourself 25% off. If you want to learn how to practice better, practice more efficient, if you want actual 1 hour practice routines, if you want some real world advice about how to approach playing in jam sessions, in recording sessions, in how to show up to rehearsal prepared. If you want to learn how to play better rhythm guitar, play better lead guitar, I promise you, this course is going to get you there. And you're going to be faster, you're going to play in better time, and you're going to have more control over your instrument if you follow everything in the course. I guarantee it. Boom. Take that. Tell you what else. I'm also about to go on tour this fall. I got an East Coast and Midwest tour. A lot of people are asking, oh, you went to the West Coast. Yeah. I got an Eastern Conference tour coming up. Mark Lettieri's coming out as a special guest with the band, and I have the band Couch opening up for the whole tour. And there's also some other secret special guests as well, which is going to be really fun. So don't miss it. Grab your tickets. You can just go wherever you think that I would be selling tickets. Just go look. I'm playing October and November, mostly November. It's going to be fantastic. Check it out. Speaking of great live shows, Kurt Rosenwinkel. I just saw Rosenwinkel at the Village Vanguard in New York City. It was so good. It was so dope. Kurt is one of the leading voices in jazz guitar for the last couple decades. And I got hip to Kurt when I was in college, devoured a bunch of records, did a bunch of transcribing in that, which now also, he's got a new book out of all of his tunes, not all of, but a lot of his tunes. We talk about it in the podcast. It is so cool. I just went through today and played through some songs. It was really fun. Kurt Rosenwinkel, incredible guitar player. Thanks for hanging. Let's get to it. Hey, you guys know about DistroKid yet? If you are an artist, musician, somebody who's trying to get your music on Spotify, Apple Music, all of those things, DistroKid is a digital distributor that can get your music on all of those platforms. It's the easiest, fastest way to do so, with accounts even just starting at $19.99 a year per artist. So for me, I have several albums out. I just pay one amount for the year. For all the Corey Wong albums, I just pay one amount, and DistroKid takes 0% royalty. 100% of the royalties come straight to me. Or you use their Teams feature where you can dedicate a certain percentage to one member of your band, a certain percentage to the other, or one of your collaborators. I do this sort of thing. It works amazing. DistroKid is who I use for my albums, and it has worked great for me. The stuff gets up there fast. They have a smart ISRC thing. I don't have to worry about coming up with my own codes, registering a lot of the stuff. They just have that. And they also have these really cool design tools. If you are not very design savvy, they'll help you come up with assets for social media and other things to help promote your album. And if you want to use them, you can use my VIP code. Just go distrokid.com/VIP/Corey Wong and you get 30% off. How about that? Check them out, DistroKid. All right, let's hit this episode. K Rose, what's happening, dude? Glad to have you on the podcast.
What's happening, man? How are you, Corey?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Doing great.
Man, you're in the middle of a residency over at the Vanguard, right?
Yeah, we're there all week.
How's that going? What's the band this time?
It's going great. I'm there with my old quartet with Mark Turner, Ben Street, and Jeff Ballard.
Is this the Next Step band?
This is the Next Step band, yeah.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, so, dude. With the new album coming, too. That's...
Yeah.
Yeah, you guys have a live record that's from 97, is that right? That's coming out?
96, yeah. It's a live album recorded at, well, it's a recording from a live concert at Smalls from 1996 when we were in the heyday of our New York era. Every Tuesday at Smalls, we had a weekly gig, and that's kind of where we developed all this music that later became my Verve, one of my Verve albums called The Next Step.
Which is an iconic album. I mean, any modern jazz guitar player has to be familiar with that. And if they're not, sorry to you and I right now, you kind of need to stop listening to this interview. Pause it. Don't stop. Just pause the interview, go on some other service, and listen to that album, because that is an iconic record, dude. That album's so good, and I'm stoked to hear this live version of it.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, it's wild because it definitely captures the vibe of Smalls back in the day and that band right at the peak of its of what it was doing back then, you know. So, and it's cool getting together again after so long. It's been really deep down there at the Vanguard playing again. It's like all the telepathy is just still there. Just add water, and it's like sea monkeys, you know.
Yeah,
just add water. So it's really great. We're having a great time. Yeah, it's cool.
That's great. I think when's the last time we saw each other? Was it at the Ground Up Festival?
Yeah,
after Hang. Was that the jam? Is that the last time I saw you?
Yeah. That was
fun Hang, man.
Yeah, that was cool.
I think that was Sharky's gig.
Maybe
Sharky was hosting.
Yeah, it was like the jam session there.
Yeah, I think so.
It was backstage of the jam session there. That was cool. Fun Hang back there. A lot of cats. Yeah, that's when we met. Yeah.
That was at the Faena Hotel they have in Miami. They have a venue there. Side note, I've never stayed at the Faena Hotel. I've actually walked in there and gotten coffee, because hot tip, you just walk in with purpose and you can get their coffee. You know, the lobby coffee. That's one of those you've toured a long time hacks.
Yeah.
But that is the best smelling hotel I've ever been in my life.
Mm. And the cucumber water, delicious.
Ooh. You know, cats are throwing down when they got the cucumber water out.
Yeah, that's, and you can just go up to the rooms, and if like the one of them's open, you can just go in there and, you know, stay for a night too. That's another hack.
Yeah, you just go in like, oh, sorry, I forgot something in here. Like, while you're cleaning, so like, if you don't mind, just like, let me. I just got back from working out. Yeah.
I got to get back into the room. I left something, and you know, you just stay for another night or two,
exactly,
or you just don't leave.
Exactly. Well, man, I'm so stoked to be hanging with you today. I actually saw you at the Vanguard a couple months ago. You were doing something where it was like classical tunes.
Oh, yeah.
With a jazz group. And it was so cool.
Oh, cool, man. Yeah, that was the Chopin Project. Thanks for coming through. I didn't realize you were there.
I was laying in the weeds, you know. I was chilling in the back. It sounded so great. And your tone was really great. I feel like, have you been changing up your tone lately? Are you, like, what's the inspiration behind your current tone? It's maybe like, I don't know if it's a compression or a tone thing, but it, maybe the attack is different or something. That's what I was noticing.
Yeah. So, you know, all my life I've been trying to kind of work on the attack portion of, you know, the transient portion of the sound, you know, because if it's too bright, you know, I mean, like, you and I are like polar opposites, you know, because you're right in there with the rhythm section, like right in there with the hi-hat. And locked, you know, like that. And so, but for me, like, I don't want to occupy the same rhythmic space as like the ride cymbal when I'm playing. Like, I want the ride cymbal to just dictate all the delineation of that feel. And I want to kind of like swim around it. So like, I'm always trying to like darken the attack or make it less sharp, transient, so that when I'm playing, I'm not like competing with the rhythm of what the drummer is doing. I'm just kind of flying like within it and around it, like more like a saxophone. So totally. Yeah, so a lot of jazz guitarists like solve that issue by just rolling off the tone, you know, and get a really really dark tone, and then it's really muffled and doesn't have that sharp transient, you know. And so I've been doing a lot of things all my life to sort of, you know, get around that, whether it's rolling off the tone or like trying to find some effects that help me do that. And like, you remember the Line 6 DL4, the green one, the floor?
Oh yeah.
Model, yeah. The delay thing. And they had like the volume swell echo, you know. And so what I would do is put that on like 100% mix and do the fastest swell. So it's actually just like swelling up the notes, you know, and that I use that a lot on, you know, on, in my playing for many years. It's on Heartcore and a lot of other albums.
And then
I'm always like, you know, looking around for things that can help me achieve this. And then kind of a few years ago, I found, the Electro-Harmonix Pog 2.
Yeah.
And that has like the attack slider, like, you know, cause I love synthesizers. I love the ADSR, you know, portion of the synth, you know, where you can shape the attack. It's like so beautiful to use that, in constructing the sound. And I just wish that we had that as guitarists as well, you know?
Yeah.
So, I'm always trying to address, that the transient portion of the sound. And so right now, I'm using the Pog 2 and it has like a attack slider. So I kind of just shave off a little bit of the attack, but I don't want like a swell effect. I want a definite note, but one that's not sharp, and that really helps me do that. But then, what I do is I use compressors before and after it to kind of like put it in as close to the moment that I actually pick the note. You know, if I really squash it, then it makes the note come out like immediately, but it doesn't have that attack portion. So that's kind of like what I've been doing.
I like that. Secret of the pros, dude.
Yeah.
That's cool.
You know, it's not perfect, but
yeah. I've heard that you're into digital modelers. Is this true?
Yeah, I'm into everything, you know, like I just like, you know, I love the fact that as guitarists, like there's this whole world of electronics that we can just experiment with. It's so cool. And so I'm into anything that, you know, I try out everything and see if it's going to help me get closer to the sound I have in my head, you know? So
yeah.
So I've tried everything, and I've had endless combinations of like using modelers with speakers or using modelers with monitor speakers, or cabinets, or just running straight into a regular amp.
Yeah.
You know, endless iterations of experimentations like that. Right now, what I'm using is a fractal FM9 floor model and running into a Fender Twin. That's what I'm using now. And sometimes even using the amp models in the fractal also with the amp, you know, because I've just found that the amp gives you that thing that you can't replace by a modeler, which is, you know, pushing air, cabinet, you know, all of the I don't even know what it is, but just the impedance and all, you know, all the ohms and impedance and everything that you get with a real speaker on stage, you know, but I love the versatility of the multi effects in those things. So
totally.
So I've been using those.
It's wild how good those things have gotten.
Yeah.
Like in the last 5 years, these things are sounding so good.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Is there a go-to, like if you open up a new modeling whatever, is there a certain amp cab combo that you go to, like if you're just starting a blank preset, what's your I mean, I know I have a weird one. I'm curious on yours, but I have a weird one that I always look for whatever reason.
Oh yeah, what is it? You're talking about?
I'll give you my answer.
The fractals.
Well, yeah, any of these. I'll give you my answer so you can think about it. But my typical thing was, I'm just going to go for a twin, try to recreate a great clean twin sound because there's so much clean headroom.
Yeah.
But on a lot of these, like the Bogner Shiva amp models are similar to the twin, but they've got like a different roundness. I don't know if it's just like the way that any amp modeling company makes these, it's like got a certain roundness to the top end.
Really?
It's like the Bogner Shiva versus a twin, they're like kind of the same-ish on the modelers, but the Bogner Shiva, anytime they have one of those, I'm like, oh, that's actually probably going to get me a closer start.
Wow, cool. I'll try that, man, because, you know, the twins are they have the headroom, like you said, but the top end is just so harsh, you know? So yeah. I've heard about the Shiva cleans, you know? Yeah. I'll try that, yeah.
Yeah, check it out.
Yeah.
And also, well, I'm going to give you after this, I'll email you a download code. I got a plugin with Neural DSP that
I saw that.
Dude, they are killing right now.
Right. That's the Cortex?
Yeah, the Quad Cortex is their floor model, which I'm right now on tour, and when I'm playing festivals and stuff, I'm running direct now.
Yeah.
And I have the outputs 3 and 4 going to an amp just so there's a little bit of something pushing the back of my legs.
Yeah.
You know, some air moving behind me, but I don't even mic it. I just use, right now it's a prototype of my plugin on the Quad Cortex, but
wow,
they got some sick stuff happening.
Yeah, man. Very curious about the Quad Cortex. I tried one and it's like, but that was in the earlier iteration of it. Somebody had one of them a long time ago, but yeah, they're happening, man. And they're so beautiful too.
Yeah, they look cool.
Yeah.
The touch screen and all that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing is now I think the other thing besides just these things all sounding great, they're now just the interfaces are so much easier to use than they've ever been, which is really fun.
Yeah, totally, man.
Yeah. Well, one thing, I want to go back to this live record, the Next Step Band Live. There's one track on there, my favorite piano player of all time, Brad Meldow.
Yeah.
Dude, was this just like him coming and sitting in on a Tuesday? Was this...
Yeah.
Explain to me what the scene was like. Because in 1996, 97, sorry, I was a kid going to Warped Tour still at the time, all right? I'm like playing in a Blink-182 cover band, right? Like this is before I mean, that being said, I was listening to Weather Report in the car because my dad got me hip to all this stuff young.
Right.
It was just like the preteen and teenage angst of whatever.
Yeah.
So
yeah, sure.
Explain to me what the scene was like then, because a lot of you cats, the people that so many of my friends and I looked up to for so many years and still do, it seems like there's so many of you that were part of this vibrant scene that was happening there. And I hear about all these stories of, oh, Meldow sat in here, Rosenwinkel sat in here, and then it ended up just being this thing. And it was just, like you're saying, that telepathy was just happening and it just was the moment. And now here we get to hear it however many years later. So can you talk to me a little bit about what that Meldow sit-in was like and what that scene was like at the time?
Yeah, sure. So like in the 90s, Smalls was happening and, you know, there was steady gigs happening from 10 to 2. Like our spot was 10 to 2. And then there was jam session. Then there was a late set from 2 to 3. And then it was 3 a.m. on jam session. Often would go, you know, go till like 5 or 6 in the morning every day. And so there was a large number of really great young musicians who were all like cutting their teeth at the same time at the club, developing their music, developing their sound, and everybody kind of bouncing off each other. And a lot of, you know, cross-pollination of ideas, and everybody was checking everybody else out, and there was so much interesting stuff going on, and at its core it was a hardcore bebop club, you know, so immense respect to all of those cats. And they were, you know, some of them were, you know, so super into the bebop thing that that was the core of it. But then around it was all this other experimentation and newer ideas. And, you know, like my band, we're doing our thing, and Omer Avital had his quintet with five saxophones, and Guillermo Klein was in the mix, and a lot of interesting stuff going on, and a lot of old school connection to the earlier eras of bebop in New York City, connected to Monk and Bud Powell and Charlie Parker. You know, cats who were hanging with those guys were at the club, at Small, sometimes even like living there. There was actually like a crawl space behind the stage where some cats would sometimes be living in there, you know, and sometimes like we would be playing and then the wall would open up and the cat would come out of the wall. And when walk through the bandstand to like, you know, go to the bathroom or something.
That's incredible.
Yeah. And there was like a former kitchen, what used to be a kitchen, you know, with a, like a walk-in freezer that had been converted into a piano practice room, and cats would be in there practicing. And there was like this kind of like makeshift library set up with like a VHS TV player with a whole bunch of like videos, jazz and records and books and stuff. And then way back in like the catacombs were all other like practice spaces where cats would be back there playing the bass, or, you know, Myron Walden would be back there practicing bass clarinet, or Zayd Nassar playing alto, or, you know, Sasha Perry in the piano room. And it was just a really thriving club. And it was all emanating from the spirit of Mitch Borden, who was the owner at the time and who later passed it on to Spike Wilner, who owns it now. So there was so much going on during that time, and so many cats that we know came up during that time, including Brad, who was around. And so like when we were playing, I just remember like he was there, and I had this new tune, and I was like, and I guess I had shown it to him before, and he came down and I was like, hey, you want to play that tune that, you know, that I showed you? And he's like, yeah, sure. And so he just got up and played with us. That was Zhivago. So it was right when I first wrote it, and it was just like, hey, you want to play that new tune of mine, you know? And he was like, yeah, cool.
Yeah.
You know? So it was really just, everybody was just all up in the mix, you know?
That sounds like such a cool creative energy and community that's happening there. Was happening there at the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, in my head, as you're talking about this, I'm kind of conflicted. I mean, I know there's versions of that in real life now, but I feel like the majority of that sort of thing, in a really good way, and in a way that's probably unfortunate because there's a certain biofeedback thing you get when you're in person, which you and I, of course, know. But I think a lot of people now growing up, they find their community through the internet and through social media, which in some ways, great. You can have a community of people from all around the world who might not be able to afford to live in New York City or even in Minneapolis here or whatever. But it's interesting, the quickness of the community now. It's a lot wider, but it's not maybe as deep. And there's just different things. There is community. But it sounds to me like you had something that was so deep there that just like it had a different level of exploration. And like you're saying, hey, I just got this new tune. You want to hang and play on it.
Yeah.
That's something you can only do in real life.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like I totally dig. I think what's going on now with Instagram is fantastic. You can discover so many people, and there's so many talented people all around the world that you can be in contact with, and you can keep up with people who you know aren't in your city and stuff. You know, like I love, for example, I love watching your videos, you know, and just seeing what you're up to, and just checking in with your vibe, man. It's awesome. I love that. And I I also like how the relationship between the artist and the audience has changed through social media, where you can give them a glimpse into your, you know, your personal space, your personality, and you know what you what you're like off stage, you know, and so that's cool. I enjoy that a lot, you know, in the modern age. But yeah, that that having a space, a physical space where everybody's going is like so so valuable and so you know, it's so rare and something something you just would love to find. You know, everybody needs like a spot where, you know, like-minded people go so that you can just, you know, bounce ideas off of each other. And yeah, it's I guess it's hard to find, but you know, I mean, talking of Smalls is still happening, you know, still doing that, you know, to this day, thanks to Spike Wilner, who's running it now and owns it. And he keeps it in the spirit that it was back in the day, you know, so it's still happening. What's it like in Minneapolis? Is there a scene? There's so much music there too, right?
Yeah, we've had a handful of jazz clubs. Some have come and gone. I cut my teeth at this place called the Artist Quarter in downtown St. Paul. It was right down the street from where I went to school. And we have this place called the Dakota that's a really good restaurant. It's a music venue. They host a lot of great jazz and jazz-adjacent shows, which is cool. Yeah. And there's some other, there's a couple newer clubs that I haven't been to yet just because I've been on the road so much. But there's such a cool scene. I grew up watching Dave King,
Happy Apple,
and Bad Plus, and all
that. I was just going to mention Dave and those cats because they're around there, right? They're from there. Ethan is from, Ethan and Dave are from there, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, that was, to me, just life altering watching those guys and a guitar player named Dean McGraw, who was a jazz guy, but also played a Strat and played wonderful acoustic guitar. He like played this Celtic music and he played Hendrix style music and he played beautiful jazz guitar all on a Strat. And it was so cool watching him as a kid, just this exploration and the way that he just invited all the other players into the scene and kind of encouraged all of us to really be artists, not just like, hey, get good at guitar. It's like, find yourself in an artistry and focus on the artistry. The guitar is the paintbrush.
You know? Yeah.
It was cool.
That's awesome.
Back to the tone and Smalls and this sort of stuff, all kind of together. I assume on most of these gigs, you're just using house amps or were you bringing your own gear?
Well, back in that day, I was even touring with my own amp. I had a flight case for my polytone and I would fly.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Unheard of now. It's like, it's can't even imagine doing that, man. Yeah. Oh,
dude.
Yeah. I was like checking in with the flight case, amp flight case and rack and.
Really? With a rack too?
Yeah. With a rack and then a bag, you know, it was just piled like high, like as high as I was going to the check-in, you know, and they're like, yeah, okay, no problem, you know,
and wow,
just fly around the world with the amp, you know, it was awesome. Loved it.
Yeah.
And then one day they're like, that'll be 500 euros, you know? And I was like, oh, those days are over now, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And
from one day to the next, it was just like, no more of that.
I could not imagine flying with an amp in a flight case right now.
I know. Yeah. That's normal, incredible. Normal check-in.
Yeah. Well, also that guitar tone. I mean, so many of us grew up listening to your guitar tone, Matheny's guitar tone, that sort of darker, rounder top end thing, warmer, full bodied. I used to try to get that. I did everything I could, but all the time when I was playing live, it would just woof out or like, woo.
Oh yeah. Woo. Yeah.
How did you control that? Or like, what's your secret to having that thick, full, dark tone, but not having it all woofy?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, because it's a that you know that's like the obsession of getting that particular balance of warmth and body, but not the not the feedback or woofiness and or like, you know, really huge lows that just blot out the rest of the band.
Yeah.
You really have to kind of taper the EQ profile so that, you know, you're tapering off on the low end just where the bass comes in, and then, like, you know, maybe giving a little bit of a mid-range boost, low mids, to get that projection, little bit of mids, you know, mid forward, and then a high frequency roll off, you know, so that it's not too bright, you know. And that's always like, I'm always like playing in those parameters, with those parameters, you know, shifting a little bit this way, a little bit that way. And then it has to do with, like, you know, with the amp that you're using. Like, I was using a Polytone for a long time, and that's solid state, so it doesn't have that huge bottom end like a tube amp. You know, the Twins, you know, you can really get a lot of heavy bass out of those. So, you know, I have the bass knob, like, you know, only a little bit, so it gets the body but doesn't get the woofiness, you know.
Sure.
So, but that's like a endless you know, subject there. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not gonna lie, I gave up on that pursuit. I needed help, man. I traded in the hollow body for the back to the Strat. I went back to the Strat and was like, I'll figure it out over here, man.
Well, you did a good job, man. You have a great time.
Well, you know, honestly, it was coming to grips with myself, like, you know what? I'm chasing something else that other people are doing on the hollow body. I don't really have my own fingerprint on that instrument, both harmonically, melodically, and tone-wise. But then when I came back to the Strat, all of a sudden I play the Strat, and people are like, oh my gosh, that sounds so much just like you.
Yeah.
And I realized I just had a thing on the Strat. So it's like, oh, okay, this is where I belong. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, man. That's fine. Yeah.
Yeah, you find yourself, you know, and, you know, you find the right paintbrushes, you know, to paint your picture, you know.
Yeah. Well, we got to talk composition, because you have a new songbook out, which I saw, and it's insane. Dude, I expected it to be, well, I don't know what I expected it to be. I didn't expect it to be so many songs. You are so prolific, and it's incredible. So many incredible tunes. And I love that you included some of the original handwritten scans of your tunes in the book, which is so fun to see. I don't know what it is. It just gives a little bit of a look inside your brain, or like how meticulous somebody is about how they write their eighth notes and how clean they are. It's like, no, there's no question on whether that's an A or a B. That's right there where it needs to be. And it was really fun to look through that book. And I'm excited to just sit down and dissect some of your writing a little bit more from looking at it.
Thanks, man. I'm so thrilled that it's finally released, you know, and that it can have a life out there with people. It's something I've been working on for about 8 years, you know, putting my tunes into a book like that. And, I didn't know how big of a project it ended up being. You know, when I started, I was just like, I got all my handwritten charts, I want to put them into Sibelius and, you know, just like that. Cause I saw other people with these really nice charts and stuff like that. So I wanted to just do that, you know, and then in the end, it ended up becoming this immense undertaking. And, we really just got into it. And in the end, I think it's about 1500 pages long, you know, and it has all of my tunes, and, just became, you know, a real labor of love. And then thinking about the physical book and what we can do with that, and I wanted to create like an art book, you know, not only just a practical book, but also something very beautiful, you know, some, a book, like a coffee table book that you could just open and it would look beautiful. And
yeah.
So the inclusion of the original manuscripts and then commentary, that became a whole thing too, like the artist commentary, you know, like me just kind of talking about all the tunes was kind of like a musical autobiography of my life. So that became an interesting dynamic of the book as well. And I'm just really, really thrilled and that it's released now, you know, cause now it can live its own life. And I'm so, happy to get, you know, feedback, you know, from people and just to have, you know, hear that people are enjoying it. And one of the things that I used to do when I was at Berkeley was, you know, like I had a friend who played saxophone named Bruce, and we would just go and get the real book and just flip to a page and just play whatever was there, and yeah. and just go, you know, just keep flipping through it and just keep playing tunes one after the other, page by page. And it was a really great way to bond with your friend, and then also to like get into this different way of engaging with music where like you're just presented with a lead sheet and you just play it, you know, just sight read it and see what happens, you know. And and that was a really great experience for me, you know, with a book, you know, with a book of tunes. And so I'm excited for people to get the chance to maybe have that experience with my book, you know.
Yeah.
And it's so cool because you can really just open it up and just start playing, and it's everything that the tune is, you know, like the scores have every part in it that will, you know, it'll all the tunes, it's just there. So yeah. it's exciting, and it was an enormous undertaking that's finally finished. So it feels really good that it's out.
That's cool, man. I'm so stoked. That's great. Well, as somebody who's written that many tunes and has a 1500 page book centered around your compositions, I'm curious, what is it to you when you approach something as a writer? Like sometimes we try to write something, we might have a goal of like, oh, I just want to write a simple, beautiful tune. Sometimes it's like, oh, I want to write something interesting to solo over. For you right now, what is your main motivator when you're writing? What are you aiming for right now when you write?
I don't think I aim for anything, honestly. You know, writing is like more of a, I don't know, more of a meditative thing, or like I'll just pick up the guitar and just start messing around, and then something will appear that's different and some kind of sound, you know, and I'll just start following wherever it leads, you know. So, and I'll find a tune somewhere, you know, and like that's really kind of how it happens for me. Well, there's sort of three different ways that songs happen for me. Like one is like that, like I just kind of stumble upon an idea and then just follow it and then find a song there. Another way is like I'll really be feeling a certain way, and then so the feeling comes through the instrument, and then there's a song there, like from a feeling, you know. And then another way is just like almost like channeling, where all of a sudden it's just like boom, a song just comes out and is just sort of like there, you know, like I didn't even follow anything or try to do anything with craft. It's just bam, like there's a song, like a discovery or a channeling or something like that. So, and then there's a fourth way, like I'll want to practice something, like, you know, I'll say like, you know, maybe I want to practice some kind of exercise or something, or like, you know, circle of fifths or something like that. Like, let's take a technical aspect of music, like a scientific aspect of music, and just kind of mess around with that. And as a practice, and then that'll turn into a song, you know. So a lot of different ways that they happen, but I kind of consider myself more of a like a midwife, you know.
Sure.
Yeah. ushering the tunes in, manifesting them, you know, a conduit, yeah. I suppose, you know. But there's a lot of craft, you know, that I try to sort of look at every tune as I'm writing it with many different vantage points, like scientific vantage point, like what's going on here, what's the relationships with these chords, what if I transpose that or do something with that, like from a scientific kind of standpoint, and then from like a experiential standpoint, like how is it making you feel, like this A section is going like this and then I feel like it wants to have, or I wanted to feel a certain, I know what I wanted to feel like when it goes from the A to the B. I just don't know what it is, but I know what the feeling is going to be. And then, so I'm sort of like in using intuitive processes to try to get that feeling, you know, something, things like that. So a lot of different, like, sort of techniques or processes that are all going on, yeah, during that whole, you know, ushering something in. But I don't really consider the songs really mine, although they are, but you know, sure, it's something more, yeah, sacred somehow, you know?
Yeah, totally. I'm just thinking through this, like there's something about it that allows you to treat it with a certain reverence and think of it as sacred, but also it allows you a certain grace with yourself. If you look back 5 years later and you're like, what was that? or like if somebody's hating on you, you're like, ah, you know, I was just the midwife, dude.
Yeah. Wasn't me.
It's not my kid, dude. I was just the one who delivered it.
Yeah.
I think that might actually in a lot of ways maybe help the psyche of what you do as an artist to kind of protect yourself or whatever, but in a great way,
in a good way. Cool. Yeah.
I have a question about playing trio, because I get in my head whenever I'm playing trio, if it's with a bass player and a drummer. So if I'm playing guitar, bass player and drummer, I sometimes get in my head of, is there enough being filled in? Is there enough information being provided? And then, as you know, as soon as you get in your head, it's like, well, all the inspiration's gone. But there's an art to the practice of playing in trio, and clearly you've really found a thing that works great. And when I listen to your trio playing, I don't ever think to myself, it'd be nice if there was a keyboard player kind of comping under this. Where when I listen to myself, I'm like, I think this would be better if there was a keyboard player. You know, can you speak to me a little bit? Here's me trying to get my guitar lesson out of you. when you approach playing with a trio, how do you decide how much information to give the listener harmonically and melodically?
Yeah, that's a great question. Again, like, man, that's like a whole life's adventure in that, you know, because like everybody knows the feeling when if you're playing trio and guitar, where you go up high and then there's this enormous space in between, yeah, what you're playing and the bass, like way down there, you know. So and if you're playing melodically, like a melody that's not like outlining the changes, it's not arpeggios, it's just a melody that, and on the chords, and you have the chords in your mind, and then you're like, oh, it's like the harmony's not activated under my melody, you know. So like I had that experience too at a certain point, and I was like, what can I do to sort of like, you know, to deal with this? And the first thing I thought of was I'll just sort of like split my attention. So play a little bit of a melody and then go down and kind of play some chordal stuff, you know, and then that'll have the effect of giving a foundation for a little while to go play more melodies, and then kind of going back and forth between those two things. thinking of it as sort of split in my mind. Like there's the melodies and then there's the chords. And then that kind of evolved for me to like both of them happening in the same time, where like I would go like, if you're going to sing a melody, like there's inevitably a moment where you hang on a note, you know, you stay on a note, you know, and the note's ringing, and that's just one finger. So you have all the other fingers. And so just the question is like, well, can I maybe do something with those other fingers that are available in that area where you are holding that note of the melody to kind of support it with some harmonics information, you know? And so, so then it becomes more integrated, and then it evolved to like, if those fingers are available while you're holding a note, then maybe you can play something that's not a chord, but is maybe like functioning as a chord with your other fingers that might be an arpeggio, you know? So you'll have both functions going on at the same time in a linear line, you know, like here's the melody, but then here's something that's like a chord, and then there's more melody, and then there's a chord around it, all like with single lines, you know? So I think it's kind of evolved to that, where like all the harmonic information is kind of contained within all the stuff that's going on in the line, but then there's also just pure melody that's happening on top of that, also in the same line, if you get me. So that's kind of how I see that subject kind of having evolved for me. And then there's also just like the like accepting or embracing that space, you know, like not being afraid of having all that space, but enjoying it, you know. That's a thing too, and that's a wonderful place if you can get to that, like not having that feeling like, oh shit, like there's no chords happening, but just like it is just a one tracing line and a bass and just being into that. And that has a lot to do with sound. Like if you're happy with your sound, then it's all beauty, right? You know, so that's key.
That's cool. And also, I listened to your solo guitar record this morning. The baritone stuff is so dope.
Oh, thanks, man. Thank you.
Like, yeah, a lot of solo guitar stuff. And actually, I was just watching, something popped up on my feed last week of some solo guitar thing you did in Berlin, where you're just kind of sitting in the middle of a room with some people hanging out.
Yeah.
It was so cool.
Thanks.
But yeah, that one, I could tell you're playing lines and you're just like, yeah, this is a guitar player sitting in front of you playing. Like it felt like that sort of intimate. You're watching somebody play stuff, and given the setting and the tone, it didn't feel like it needed anything else. It felt appropriate for what it was, which is really cool. And I think, like you're saying, your last point of this is allowing that space and embracing it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a big one. I was reading something that Julian Lage was saying the other day, which really I thought it hit the nail on the head. Like he was saying that, like, if you're okay with what's happening on stage, then everyone else will be too, you know?
Yeah.
And
I like that a lot.
Isn't that great?
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's so good.
He's awesome.
Oh my gosh. He's amazing. Gosh.
Yeah.
He's incredible.
Yeah.
He's. I mean, talk about eras of jazz guitar. I in my mind, I have an idea of certain sounds and evolution of jazz guitar and sort of, well, people that play improvised music in general, just on the guitar. In your mind, how do you think about the lineage of jazz guitar? Do you think of it in eras? And if you do, what are those eras of jazz guitar, you know, from the beginning to where it is now?
Oh, bro. I'm not much of a historian, you know, but everything's all just mixed up experientially. In my, accessing of everything that I've listened to, you know, there was a lot that I, for a long time, I didn't even know what I was listening to because I was just listening to the radio in Philadelphia. And, sure. So I don't have a kind of encyclopedic, relationship with like, you know, the delineating eras and stuff like that. But I mean, basically, I mean, you could say Charlie Christian to Wes to, Freddie Green in there and to Benson and to, you know, and then you're already into McLaughlin and Pat and Holdsworth and all the cats, Frizzell and Stern. Yeah. And, you know, Kevin Eubanks. And I think the guitar in jazz really, really blossomed in the 70s and the 80s, you know, even yeah. though, you know, and Grant Green is one of my favorites. So it's like, you know, Wes and Grant Green kind of were like the cats, you know, maybe in the 60s, you know, in the 50s, you know, there's like Billy Bauer. And I love Billy Bauer. And he did a lot of work with like the Tristano group of cats and Charlie Christian and and Joe Pass and Jim Hall. There's not that many, Kenny Burrell. So it really has this like exponential kind of populated effect through the history of jazz. Like, you know, guitar and mm-hmm. jazz is kind of more recently, you know, developed, I think. Mm-hmm. And then I'm just blanking on Stefan Grappelli and the
Django.
Django, yeah. Django's in there, of course, too. Incredible,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, totally.
So I love all those guitarists, you know. I pretty much love every guitarist.
Yeah.
You know, I love everybody, you know.
I do too. If they have something interesting to say on the instrument, I love guitar players. I love guitar players. So you grew up in Philly?
Yeah. Yeah. Pat Martino.
Were you around Martino or Jimmy Bruno or those cats? Yeah. Were those?
Yeah. Jimmy Bruno. Not Pat. Pat was, he wasn't playing when I was growing up. He had his aneurysm and he was like recovering and was not out playing, you know?
Yeah.
So I never met him until later, but I heard Jimmy Bruno a lot and I would sometimes sit in with him in Philly. Yeah. And he's amazing. Yeah, he's like a big band on guitar.
Yeah. Do you have somebody that you consider a mentor to you?
No. No. A couple key people here and there, you know, throughout mm-hmm. my life, you know. I had a wonderful piano teacher in Philadelphia named Jimmy Amity, who was incredible. And he used to play with Stan Kenton and he had like really bad disease in his hands, so he couldn't play. Like he had doctors told him he wouldn't ever be able to play, and by the time I was studying with him he was able to play 15 minutes a day, and he would go and do record dates knowing that as soon as that record date was over he would have to go into the hospital and like recover for 6 months.
But
he would do it, you know, but that would be like very, very rare. Every few years, maybe he would do it. And the rest of the time, he's like playing very quiet and almost nothing, you know. but he developed this whole way of maximizing your economy of note choices and voicing.
Well, man, it is so great to hang with you today. So fun to have you on the podcast, finally. Good luck with the rest of your shows. Good luck with the book and the album release. I am so excited for everything you have going on and looking forward to the next time we can hang.
Thanks a lot, Corey. I really appreciate it, man. It's really great to hang with you. And thanks a lot for having me on your podcast, man. And I look forward to seeing you again soon. All right. Thanks, buddy.
Thanks, dude.
There you have it. Kurt Rosenwinkel. What a great dude. Nice guy. Incredible guitar player. Cat's playing gigs, man. I love that. Always getting better. Just in the hotel room practicing, warming up, getting ready, getting the mind, getting the hands ready. I love that. Hey, like I said at the intro of this podcast, I got a sale going on my guitar course. 25% off. Use the discount code PODCAST. Go get it now. Make sure you get tickets for my upcoming tour, Eastern Conference Tour in the U.S. in October and November with Mark Lethierry and Couch as special guests. We'll see you there. We'll see you next time. Peace.